We kicked off another week on Monday, February 3rd. Mark Fitch among the guests from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy in Connecticut on tolls and what's really going on with the General Assembly on some hot-button issues. We checked in with a local college professor, as we like to do, regarding what's up with impeachment and the Democrats' nominating process. And also another update on tolls, keeping an eye on it for us, Republican State Senator Tony Wong of Fairfield. Mark Fitch writes the Fitch Files and other good stuff for the Yankee Institute of Connecticut. Mark, how are you on this fine Monday? How are you doing?
It's getting busy. It's getting busy with the session coming up. And, it's keeping me typing away. So
yeah.
I'm doing all right.
Yeah, thanks for the time. Listen, first of all, kudos to you for a nice breakdown, Mark, of the toll bill as you saw it, as we all got that draft last week. Very nice breakdown. I put it on the station Facebook page, my Facebook page. Of what's in it, more importantly, what's not in it. And again, Mark, as you did and other people are doing here, especially in the media and in the legislature itself, you know, we seem to be focused on this controversial Section 8 here, which I know you've highlighted and some legislative leaders have highlighted, kind of, Mark, leaves the door open with some nebulous language of what Governor Lamont or any other governor could do to eventually toll passenger vehicles.
Yeah, this was, we noticed this pretty quickly. And then, Senate Republican President Len Fasano brought it up at a press conference. But yeah, there does appear to be a bonding loophole in the legislation that could allow for the bond covenants to be altered. So when the state lends out money, when it bonds money, it has an agreement with the bondholders that this is where your money's going to come from, and you know we're not going to make any changes to anything. So the bondholders can be assured that they get paid. But those covenants can be changed. It's been done in the past. Just last year, it was changed. As long as you can ensure that the bondholders can get their money, you can make changes to those covenants. And, as Senator Fasano pointed out, if you expand the tolls to include cars, well, that's just a ton more money coming in, and bondholders could be very assured that they would make all their money back that they were hoping to get. So there is that loophole in there. Even as House Speaker Joe Arasimowicz has said, no legislation can bind the hands of future legislators. So yes, a future General Assembly could come in and say, well, we're going to vote to do something different, and they could do that. So, that's where it stands right now. And as far as those, the legislature, the toll proponents in the legislature keep saying, well, there's no appetite for tolling cars. I mean, you say that now, but last year you were really, really hell-bent on tolling cars. So there is an appetite. It's just that they don't think they can do it politically. So that's a big distinction to make.
Yeah. Mark, do you think that what any of the transportation committee members heard last week in a very pointed public hearing, first from legislators, from experts, and then from the public, do you think something like that made any sort of a difference, or was it just an exercise in theater? Hang on, I want to get your answer to that when we come back. Mark Fitch is the guest from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy in Connecticut. We'll ask him about that public hearing last week. What did he think? Traffic and weather together on the 6s. Still no tolls on WICC. And one of our timely check-ins from our buddy Mark Fitch. He writes the Fitch Files for the Yankee Institute for Public Policy in Connecticut. Yes, believe it or not, even here in Blue Connecticut, there is a conservative think tank. Mark, the public hearing last week, was it just a dog and pony show, all of an act? Or do you think anybody at the Capitol really was listening to all that?
I wouldn't go see. It was theater, but it was necessary theater. And because pretty much everybody who serves on the Transportation Committee had their minds made up. The House, lawmakers in the House and Senate have their minds made up as far as what they want to do. I think the biggest consideration that they have is whether or not it's politically feasible to do it, especially in an election year. They seem to think that it is, because one of the reasons I say it was necessary theater is that they've already supposedly scheduled a vote to be held February 10th, which is it's 1 week away. So they needed to get that public hearing out of the way. And that way they can say that they did their due diligence and they heard from the public, and they can just file an emergency certification on the bill and head straight into a vote in the House and Senate to supposedly pass this. There's still a bit of wrangling, and I'm sure, as you know, we've heard a dozen times over the past couple of years that it's going to be voted on, a tolls bill will be voted on, and it doesn't happen. So it's another instance of hearing from legislative leaders that, yes, this is totally going to happen, and then you wait and wait, and maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. You know, obviously the special session on tolls got canceled, so it's I think the public hearing, it was theater, but it was necessary theater for legislative leaders to advance this this tolling agenda.
Mark, do you think any of the Democratic members who vote yes on this, and there might be a few here and there, do you think any sizable number of them will be, I guess the description could be, you know, would they be signing their political death warrant on this in an election year? Do you anticipate any losses on this based primarily on a toll vote?
I mean, it's absolutely possible, but I think with the majority numbers that they have, particularly in the House, you know, they could essentially shield some Democrats from having to vote yes on this. So they have enough votes to pass by a simple majority. And so they can tell Democrat representatives or senators in tough districts and potential swing districts, you don't have to vote on this. You can vote no and go back to your constituents and say that you voted no, because we have enough people who are safe in their districts to vote on this. So there's a lot of political calculation going on. And I think that it kind of plays out with, you know, you saw a lot of reports saying that they couldn't decide which chamber would go first, whether it would be the House of Representatives or the Senate, because it appears like neither one of them is really confident, even though they keep saying they are. But, you know, in the Senate, you could do 18 votes with a tie-breaking vote by the lieutenant governor, and you'd be shielding, you know, four senators from a potentially politically difficult vote.
Yeah, in fact, I did see also in one publication, it wasn't yours, but somebody said, you know, somebody was doing a headcount guess in the Senate on that, Mark, and they said that's quite a possibility with, you look at, you know, that handful of Democrats in the Senate that you know, are kind of centrist Democrats and maybe even a little center-right who might need some shielding on this. I continue to be interested and scratching whatever hair off I have left on my head regarding the fact that they just don't clam up on this, Mark. Wait till the elections are over in November, and then if you regain your majorities, you could just put the whole thing through in a couple of days and have 2 years for this thing to, you know, to kind of settle into the psyche of the state. That's still, Mark Fitch, that whole thing, the timing of this still fascinates me.
Yeah, and it's this, and I think the timing is part of what bothers the legislative leaders as well, you know, and I think that there's been a tremendous push by the governor and trying to get this through as quick as possible, and, you know, more experienced lawmakers are kind of trying to stall. And we've seen that for the past year, and we've seen that throughout the summer and now into the fall and now into winter. They've been stalling because they probably agree with you. You know, they probably think that, you know, going into the next election, they might have some losses, but they'll, you know, it would take a lot of losses for them to lose their majorities. So they're probably hoping that this can be put off a year, but with the governor pushing the way he is, it's come down to, well, we're going to have to get this done, because otherwise this argument continues on into the next election, and the Republicans are just going to use it to just hammer them.
And I continue, Mark Fitch, who's the guest from the Yankee Institute. Mark, I continue to be fascinated with Alex Bergstein, the freshman senator from Greenwich. And I've said this before, I can disagree with her on this policy, but I kind of find it oddly refreshing that she seems to be, and I'm thinking if anybody else has said this, Mark, and I don't think they have, she seems to be the only member of the entire Democratic caucus in her first term that's kind of flipping tables on this and breaking glass and saying, well, the way you're doing this is a joke. If you're going to do tolls. But if not, she says, I don't like this. And there must be some head plans into desks at the Capitol every time she opens her mouth.
Yeah, you know what? I will give her this. You know, like she when she wants something, she definitely goes for it. And Senator Bergstein says that she is not supporting the truck only tolls because she wants tolls on everybody, cars and trucks. That is probably not a popular position to take either, you know, either publicly with voters or, you know, with your friends in the legislature. So she's kind of being a thorn in the side, but I will agree with you. It is somewhat refreshing to see someone say, this is what I want, and I'm not going to vote on something if I don't get it. Even though I think tolls on cars and trucks is not going to work out so great, but you know, she's sticking by her guns, and she is a wild card in the Senate.
Have the efforts, Mark Fitch, do you think the efforts of, if it goes even beyond tolls here, have the efforts of people like Patrick Sasser and the NoTollsCT.org group, you know, have we learned that maybe even without initiative and referendum in this state, that enough people can stand up and maybe at least make their voices heard on certain public policy?
Absolutely. I mean, the No Tolls Connecticut movement has really, it's been an important factor in Connecticut's this new vibrant grassroots organization. They're up there all the time. And let's look at this. You know, when this tolling argument first started under Governor Malloy, they were talking about upwards of 121 congestion tolls on every single strip of highway in Connecticut.
Jeez.
Now we're down to talking about 12 tolls on 12 bridges for only trucks. That is a huge victory for the no tolls movement. So they started wanting, you know, they started out wanting 353 miles, and now they're down to arguing over a couple inches. So I think it does show that, you know, popular uprising can change the course of things in the state, because they could have passed Malloy's bill. They could have passed Lamont's bill last year, which would have been 50 some odd gantries. Now they're down to 12 truck only gantries. And that is a huge victory, regardless of what happens with this latest bill. It shows that when you get a grassroots movement that is, you know, activated and organized and, you know, has a strong voice up there, you can get a lot done, and you can make some lawmakers be a little worried about what they're voting on.
Mark, hang on. I want to do one more segment with you if we can. I want to talk, shift gears here, talk about marijuana and maybe gambling and more. Mark Fitch is the guest. He writes the Fitch Files column, the reports on a almost weekly basis for the fine folks at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy in the state. We'll talk about gambling. We'll talk about marijuana and all that straight ahead. Traffic and weather together on the sixes here. 3:46 on a Monday on WICC. 10 before the top of the hour, 10 before 4, we'll get an impeachment update coming up top of the hour at 4 right here on WICC 600, online at WICC600.com. We continue with Mark Fitch, Fitch Files writer for the Yankee Institute for Public Policy in Connecticut. Okay, Mark, setting the toll monster aside for a minute, two other things that suddenly rise up out of the dead are an expansion of gambling, which sounds like it's got a little momentum this time, hooked in with sports gambling and marijuana. I'm guessing, Mark, and I may be wrong on this, that one of those two may get done in the session. I can see the gambling thing happening. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think gambling is probably more likely to happen than marijuana. I just, for some reason, they made you know, legal pot sales an issue last year that they were really going to try to push through, and just it can't seem to get done. And I know a lot of people think that, you know, legalizing cannabis will, you know, kind of solve the state's fiscal problems. It won't. I can tell you. And I should also preface this by saying Yankee Institute's not taking a position on either of those issues. But the revenue that they're talking about bringing in from, you know, cannabis sales, it would not be enough to really put a dent in any of Connecticut's major issues. As far as sports betting, you know, who knows? But, you know, they always talk about casino expansions, and I think we've gotten to the point in Connecticut where you're looking at an oversaturation of the market.
Yeah.
You have Springfield, you have Foxwoods, you have Mohegan, and now, you know, they want to put one in Windsor and maybe Bridgeport, and there's a lot of different, you know, a lot of different ideas going around about how to get the most money out of, you know, potential gambling revenue. And, you know, yeah, there's money to be had there. But once again, not enough to solve the state's problems. You know, when people look to, you know, Colorado and Massachusetts, and they say, hey, you know, they legalized marijuana and look how well they're doing. They're not doing that well.
No, they're not.
Doing that well because of that.
No.
And they have a lot of other positive things going on in those states.
Yeah, and again, Mark, something I tell people that you obviously follow, being in the business you are, you know, there is a significant problem now, Mark, I read, in both California and Massachusetts, with a significant black market for marijuana that still survives. Why? Because it's overtaxed now by those states. So you have people who buy these amounts, who can afford it, and make their money back and make money by selling to people on the street who can't afford the legal prices. Why? Because it's overtaxed. And I just sit there and shake my head at this.
Well, yeah, and the ideas and proposals being put forward, I mean, it involves a lot of taxes. And, you know, the state is going to take more than their fair share if they legalize any of these things, because if they legalize it, they're not doing it because, you know, it's morally right. They're not doing it because it, you know, affects certain, you know, income brackets more than others, or it affects the inner cities more than others. They're doing it for the money. And so you can be sure that if they do pass this, there will be heavy taxation because they want that revenue. And I think it's just an interesting commentary on the state of Connecticut when you might have an idea that a lot of people think is good, but the only way you're going to get the state to do it is when it's so broke that it has nothing else it can actually tax other than opening up a new revenue stream.
Which means that we can get high and bet on the New York Jets at the same time. There you go. That'll soothe my pain.
That's some good thinking there, Paul. That's some good thinking.
Being a long-suffering Jets fan here, I think, yeah, I can blast up on Sunday and sit home and watch my Jets lose. Mark, as always, thanks, man. We'll keep an eye out for your stuff coming down the pike. Mark Fitch from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy in Connecticut here. Mark, thanks. We'll be in touch.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Yeah, that's it, folks. We'll be able to light up, get some of that kush going. Little Pineapple Express, Strawberry Kush there, while you can bet on the Jets. Hey, you know what? I could say the Jets and the Giants, all right? All right? Lay down a little cash, a little money line, a little point spread, two-team parlay, you're all good. All right. A background, Professor Wharton once served as a congressional aide to former U.S. Rep. Charlie Rangel, Democrat New York, and former U.S. Senator Congressman Christopher Shays of Connecticut. Also, he's a former chair of the New Haven Republican Town Committee, served as an advisor at Southern for both the College Democrats and the College Republicans as well. Professor Wharton, Paul here. How are you?
Thanks so much for the intro. Appreciate that.
Boy, and I see you've kind of made an effort to be on both sides of the aisle here. It sounds like that to me.
At least on this campus, I try my best to make an imprint here to get both sides to talk and get things to get off the ground.
All right, do me a favor. I'll love you immediately if you can please, for the love of God, Professor, how do these freaking caucuses work? I've been following politics for 30 years, and I read it over and over again, and I say, just do a primary for the love of God, please.
Well, caucuses are unique because they're trying their best to involve as many people as possible in one sitting. So one could argue they're probably the most democratic, but also the most chaotic forms of decision making.
And if you know how to work them, I mean, President Obama's guy, his campaign manager, I think David Plouffe said
right
that part of the reason that Barack Obama did so well early on against Hillary Clinton was they knew how to game or to work the caucus system.
But so it's an interesting system because the Democrats have a unique system in Iowa compared to the Republicans. You know, both parties do caucuses. But the difference among the Democrats, the fact that you had to be deemed viable, which means you had to gain at least 15% support in the first vote. And then they have this bizarre kind of tracking system and scoring system, which was developed by a graduate student at Iowa University to come up with a ranking order. So it's not your typical traditional, let's get everybody in a room and decide things out. The Republicans tend to be a little cleaner on it. You know, they tend to make it a little easier. Everybody makes the first decision and then they whittle it down. Not the Democrats. Those people who are undecided tend to be in the center of the room, and then everybody's trying to have a go at finding them and get them on their side of the room to get that viability. Calling at least.
Yeah, and I noticed this time, Professor, that they are trying different things, trying to get more people involved, going high tech with some things, and also allowing. I saw something over the weekend where they're allowing Iowa residents to now participate remotely if they're going to be out of the state as well.
Exactly. I think they're trying to get as many people to participate, whether those people are there or not. But I guess my concern is, and call me a purist, Paul, I'd rather have everybody in the room because you get a better sense of what somebody is thinking in the first place as opposed to doing things remotely.
Before we hooked up this afternoon, I was talking about the fact that the process we're in now, although it's steeped in tradition, Iowa, the first caucuses, New Hampshire, the first primary coming up a week from Tuesday. Professor, there are a lot of people who say, listen, this is all fine and good, but you have contests going on mainly in two predominantly white states early going where it could grossly affect fundraising. And it's not all that fair for somebody who may be a candidate of color, who may have an urban voter base. What are your thoughts on that?
I think quite the opposite, actually. I mean, Barack Obama, as you said earlier, was able to get through.
Yeah.
So Iowa did and has voted for, a candidate of color. So it's not to say that it's not possible. In fact, it is. I think it's just more a matter of who all the other candidates are that can box each other out. And I think we're seeing that problem play out right now with all these candidates running the Democratic ticket.
Professor
in both states.
Yeah, Professor Wharton, stand by. I'll be back to you. Hang on there. Traffic and weather together on the sixes right here at WICC 600. Online, of course, at WICC600.com. From Southern Connecticut State University, Associate Professor of Political Science Jonathan Wharton on the line, joining us for a few minutes as we lead up to news here, talking about what's going on today and what's going to go on this week, also with impeachment and all that, the final vote coming up in the Senate. You know, Professor, it certainly looks like, from all indications, that many in the Democratic Party are really worried that Bernie Sanders may be the real deal here. You know, they're suddenly going to let Mike Bloomberg in the debate, maybe in Nevada. Are they in full panic mode here?
They have to be. I mean, the mere fact that you have a viable candidate running again and it's getting this kind of attention, certainly through the polls and even through donations. I mean, he got 1.53 million alone that one day last week is amazing. So, and yet I'm constantly reminding my students and even Democrats themselves that, you know, Bernie Sanders is not technically a registered Democrat. Certainly he certainly is, you know, caucuses with them in the U.S. Senate, but he is not a registered Democrat. So it's fascinating that this might be the candidate on the ticket.
Yeah, and it's fascinating, Professor, that if they're this worried about Bernie, and I've always said this, if they're this worried about Bernie, then tell him, now, I don't know legally if they could do this, but say, Senator, you know, God, we love you, God, but this time around, we want this to be a Democratic nominating process. You're not a Democrat. Now, of course, they're worried about a third-party run. I get that, but they're right. Kind of damned if they do and damned if they don't.
And look what happened the last time. You know, when this happened the last time, there were some concerns about what happened with Donna Brazile and her role of giving those questions in advance mm-hmm. to Hillary Clinton. So it's not like the Democrats would want to sabotage. They have. So there is a possibility that this could happen again against Bernie Sanders. And I'm sure you've heard some of this concern among some of those people who are supporters of Bernie Sanders.
Absolutely. Professor, hang on. We'll be with you right back after we do a quick news update. The guest for a few more minutes after the news, Associate Professor of Political Science, Professor Jonathan Wharton. He's worked with Democratic Congressman Charlie Rangel and also former Fairfield County Congressman Christopher Shays, works with the College Democrats and the College Republicans at Southern Connecticut State University. Okay, straight ahead to news, top of the hour, then traffic and weather together, then we will return. Right here, WICC 600 on the radio and online at WICC600.com. Yes, you are, and thank you for doing that. We sincerely appreciate it, like Mr. Big Voice says. We're 203-333-9422, 203-333-WICC. Our buddy Fairfield Republican State Senator Tony Wong is going to join us in a few minutes to find out what is going on, if anything, regarding the toll bill. We're not really sure if and when that's going to happen. Staying national right now, a few more minutes. He's been kind to give us, Associate Professor of Political Science at Southern Connecticut State University, Jonathan Wharton, on the line with us as we are looking at the start of the nominating season for the Democratic Party and also kind of the wind down here of impeachment. Professor, your students at Southern and what you see on campus, what you hear, what you say, are they tuned into the impeachment thing or not?
They are. As a matter of fact, I have a bunch of them sitting outside my office, and we were just talking about it. And so I think there's been some interest in terms of what will happen this week, as well as what might take place tomorrow night with the State of the Union. In the sense, you know, how is this going to get the country to move on to addressing other issues?
Boy, I tell you, the battle lines are really drawn for November. And the president yesterday, the line about Mike Bloomberg needing a box for the debate. You know, the guy's base, it doesn't move. If anything, Professor, I don't know whether you saw, his numbers actually over the past couple of weeks have inched up in a few polls. How do you account for that? What is going on here?
That's not surprising. He's always stuck at around 40%. Quite frankly, if you look at Barack Obama's numbers, it's always been somewhere in the high 30s and even in the 40s. You really since – one could argue since even the 80s. You can even go back to the 70s with some presidential popularity ratings. It's rare that it gets above 60%. You know, even if it gets to 50%, that's a surprise. George W. Bush did have a bump up after 9/11, but then it went back down. So there are these moments when, the popularity ratings will go up and they'll go down. But at 40%, that's pretty much all you really need to win the presidency these days.
Yeah, and especially with the fact that the Trump campaign has pretty much conceded the fact that they're not going to win the popular vote. They don't want to win the popular vote. They're not interested in it. They are mapping out a strategy for the Electoral College. And I tell people who are, you know, tend to be a tad more liberal than me, I said, no, you can't look at the poll numbers. You have to look at how he's running in these swing states. And you look at some of these poll numbers in the swing states kind of on a micro basis, and he's either tied with or slightly ahead of pretty much everybody in the field in these five or six states.
What I remind my students is that when it comes to electoral college, that does matter. But you have to think of it as 50 different buckets. And where are you putting all your votes in terms of where these buckets are all located? And that's what matters at the end of the day. It's not a matter of you're putting more emphasis in the bigger bucket. It's a matter of looking at across the board and seeing, you know, which state has got the real possibility of putting more energy into.
And if and when, you know, if President Trump is, he won't be removed Wednesday, but if he loses in November or serves out four more years, years, he'll eventually be gone. The Republican Party, I tell people, I think anyway, Professor, you're still going to have Marco Rubio there and Ted Cruz and, you know, Nikki Haley and some of these, you know, kind of up-and-comers, Ben Sasse. So the core of the party is still going to be there. Look at the Democratic side, though, for a minute. And once the Steny Hoyers, the Bernie Sanders, the Dianne Feinsteins, the Nancy Pelosi's all go away, they're very old. They're not going to be around for too much longer. Where does the Democratic Party go? You know, it's interesting. AOC said something, and as much as I don't like her politics, I thought, Professor, she did say something really astute the other day. She said, you know, there's no real place in the Democratic Party or in American politics right now for a real progressive kind of British Labor Party movement. What do you think happens with the Democrats down the line 2, 4, 5 years from now?
So the, as you're speaking towards, many political scientists have called this a generation gap right now, because obviously the boomers have been in charge for a long time, have remained in Congress for decades, obviously. And so it's a matter of at what point will they step down, retire, you know. And so there is going to be some kind of shift within the next few years, not just in Congress, but even in your state legislatures. Typically, political scientists like to call it a party alignment when it's shifting almost every generation, and we're overdue for some of that. So you're going to see this internal kind of decision-making in terms of who will be the leaders in the future very soon.
Although I did see, Professor, I don't know whether you saw this, that believe it or not, if New York does lose a congressional seat, I did see that AOC could maybe suffer here in a move to maybe chop up her seat, which could be pretty interesting if they're going to go that route. They may be playing with fire here, though, I think.
True, and many of the party leaders can decide how these maps will be drawn, and so they might very well do that. You know, this is not unusual. I've seen this happen even when I worked for Charlie Rangel when they had to merge the districts back in the 90s. So it's not to say that this can't happen. It has happened before where some districts are targeted, and it's just a matter of how you kind of reconfigure those maps. But sometimes it can be an effort to usually move another candidate out of the way.
Final question. What kind of what did you get, Professor, out of working for a guy like Charlie Rangel on one side of the aisle, and then you did work also for a longtime congressman on this end of the woods, Chris Shays, ideologically on the other end of the spectrum? You don't see that often, at least in the people that I've talked to. What made you do that?
It's a rarity. And some people, even some of my friends still on Capitol Hill, call me a throwback Wharton, that I was able to work on both sides, right, which is almost unheard of.
Yeah.
But it was not that unusual back in the 90s. I mean, you know, many people forget that Chris Shays was actually technically a centrist.
Yeah.
You know, there were moments when he was a liberal, and he would work on the other side of the aisle. Sometimes Charlie Rangel would do it. Not as often, but every once in a while. I will say one thing that they both had in common, they were very effective with constituent relations. Mm-hmm. And that's what matters, is what kind of ground game do you have in addressing constituent concerns?
Associate Professor, Political Science, Southern Connecticut State University, Professor Jonathan Wharton. Professor, thank you. Hopefully we can touch base in the future. Appreciate it. Thanks.
Anytime. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Bye-bye. All right, there you go. Getting under the skin of New Haven Democratic State Rep Roland Lamar. Tony Wong, I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that little exchange you had with Representative Lamar as you two were sparring a little bit about what was in the bill and what wasn't in the bill. I thought you were perfect there, Tony. You weren't out of line at all.
Well, thank you. I mean, when the chairs set up rules for a impromptu prior to session public hearing, and then literally says to every legislator who is empowered to sit on the Transportation Committee representing their districts, representing the focus of transportation, and on an issue of tolls that will impact so many of our commuters that are listening to you right now, and then to say, you got 5 minutes, get to work. And so my thought was, okay, then let's get to work. I've got the Commissioner of Transportation, I've got the Budget Secretary. So my question is just plain a yes or no answer. Does this toll plan include any money for rail systems like Metro North that is so critical to our quality of life and business sustainability in southwestern Connecticut. Doesn't include any money for it. I said just a yes or no. And obviously you notice that Chairman Lamar didn't like that. Because the truth of the matter is, it's no. It did not include any money to address the critical area of rail system improvements for our commuters.
And Tony,
is frustrating.
You're talking to a guy here. I got home early from working it overnight in New York before I did the show here, and sure enough, my train was sitting in Stamford for an extra 30 minutes this morning heading north up the corridor because of, guess what, you know, signal problems, folks. We've got signal problems. You know, it's almost a daily occurrence here, Tony. So why isn't any of this money going to go to maintain the stations, maybe beautify them a little bit, more rail work, more work on the catenary lines, signal problems? We always hear about stuff going on in Stamford and Norwalk and that bridge, but I think you nailed them the other day. You showed none of this money is heading for the busiest, heaviest traveled commuter railway in the U.S.
Absolutely. And I think as you look at this bill, 32 pages after nearly 4 years of debate and intensive debate for the past year, where there were three iterations. And you know, I also asked that the governor's CT 2030 plan, that is the touted plan on his website that we have pointed to as the solution. And may I add that it's a solution that Republicans and Democrats complimented the governor in presenting. But the reality was it had a comprehensive rail solution. It had a comprehensive transportation solution. It had a comprehensive prioritization of projects so people know transparency. None of that is in this truck only supposedly bill. So the fact is, there's an inconsistency of selling one thing, but having a toll trucks only quote unquote bill that is totally different. You know, they should really clarify that CT20 and strip everything to reflect what you're selling to the public. And again, it was simply a yes or no. Is the trail improvement that it's cited in 2030 included in this current bill that you're trying to sell to vote on? It's a yes or no. Yeah. The answer is an emphatic no, but that doesn't sound well for this bill, does it?
No. Tony, hang on. We'll be right back to you. Traffic and weather together on the sixes here. Another update. We're trying to figure out what's up with the toll bill in Hartford. It's a Monday at WICC. And the question remains, will trucks, the big ones in your neighborhood, be paying tolls followed by cars? Tony Wong, our good buddy from the General Assembly, Fairfield State Senator on the Republican side, trying to keep us updated on that. So, Tony, I was speaking earlier today to Mark Fitch from the Yankee Institute. He said there's still, I guess there's still a tentative a vote day coming up on this in the next week or so. Is that what you're hearing?
Well, absolutely. They're trying to get this done as soon as possible, hopefully that people will forget toward the end of session in the first week of May and then going to November elections. Because people need to remember, when this bill gets passed, they won't feel tolls for another year and a half. And they hope that this gets through under I don't know what, and I'm being polite here. But ultimately, you know, nobody in that testimony believes it's going to be truck only. And the numbers don't add up, as some of the scuffle that ensued in the debate occurred, where the chairs were challenging the veracity of some of these people that questioned the data points. The other critical part is the creation of a transport policy authority. Individuals that get appointed, a majority of which by the governor, but they are not elected and they are not politically accountable. These will be the people that will be setting rates into the future. And there are clauses and loopholes that said if we don't meet bond requirements and the dollar amounts don't meet the needs that we have, that we can increase the number of tolls because there's no limit. It cites 12, but there's no limit on how many more we could have and what kind of vehicles we would tax. So there is tremendous loophole. You can say till the blue moon comes out that we won't do it, but the language doesn't say it. In 32 pages, there is no explicit language that says trucks only, period, 12 tolls only, period. And if I asked that as a yes or no question before getting rebuked, the answer would have been again, no. And that's troubling because it's not enough money for what the projects are undertaking that we need to address.
Mm-hmm.
I've said all along, Democrats and Republicans agree that we need to address our infrastructure and transportation needs. We just disagree in how you pay for it. And this bill is not enough money to pay for all that we need to do. So what are you trying to say? Let's pass something, and when the need comes up, we'll just adapt to it. That is, in my mind, not a good representation and a very bad bill.
So today, as we speak, Tony, you and I at 5:41 here on a Monday, do the Democrats have the votes or not?
Well, I hope not, and I hope that this bill and the public hearing and the outcry of people that have talked about businesses closing, talked about, you know, Reverend Holloway, Apostle Holloway, talking about how the bullying tactics of the chairs is a disappointment and frustration to the people that can't spend 10-plus hours waiting in line to talk. So I hope this is an opportunity where people are getting their voices heard. But you know what's fascinating, Paul, and I hope they listen. You know, the Hearst, Connecticut media, which represents a majority of the papers in Fairfield County, from the Stanford Advocate, the Norwalk Hour, our local papers in Fairfield, as well as Connecticut Post and the Danbury News Times, they came out, their entire editorial board came out and said, you should not, as a General Assembly, vote for this bill.
Yep.
It's incomplete, it's insufficient, it's cobbled together, and it's not sufficient. It's not even an issue about the revenue and what we're looking to do. It's just not a good enough plan with way too many loopholes, and we shouldn't pass it. We should pass something that's comprehensive with a revenue solution that everybody can agree to.
Tony, thank you. Keep us updated on this. We know you will, and we'll talk in the coming days. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. Tony Wong there. Okay, so no.